This is Dr. Jimmy Nichols, equine nutritionist. On this podcast, we will explore unique cases, debunk popular myths, and break down advanced research data. Join me for a little fun, a lot of science, and some real-world advice for feeding horses. Hey everyone, it's Dr. Jimmy. Welcome to episode 115 of The Feed Room Chemist. It is spring, the grass is getting green, or at least it's trying to get green in most parts of the United States. I personally could really use some rain out in my part of the world. I don't know about you guys. We have had dust storms kicking around with sustained winds of like 25 to 35 miles an hour and then gusts up to like 60 to 80 miles an hour. Let me just tell you, from a horse management standpoint, there are a few things that can go very wrong on days that the wind is blowing like that. I mean, you have to strap everything down or lock it in a building, one of the two. Like, if you have muck buckets sitting empty in front of your stalls, they are gone to the next county. Large rubber pans out in the feet in the pasture, racing the tumbleweeds down the county road. Oh, and then like those extra heavy, you know, like 4-foot by 6-foot stall mats that are awkward even for like two strong normal humans to maneuver anywhere. Yeah, like don't even think about those staying in place. They will be doing cartwheels across your backyard. Then like there's also the basic necessities, right? Like trying to actually keep hay in your horse's pen or in their pasture for more than 10 seconds so that your horse can actually eat it, right? This is, in all honesty, this is where my hay chicks nets come in for the major win. Just stuff them in there, clip them to a fence, and you're good to go. But at the end of a day like this, then like when the wind finally does lay and you go out and you assess all of the damage and the things you have to go searching for, and you also have to go dump and refill every water tub and bucket and tank on the place because there's like this nice little layer of mud that has basically settled to the bottom of all of them. And then the top has this nice little layer of red dirt film. Have I convinced anyone to move out here yet? Actually, I think the ridiculous wind kind of keeps most people from moving here, and I kind of like it that way. So, I mean, trust me, I wouldn't trade the crazy wind for all of the moss-covered, mold-growing, mosquito-infested land in the country. I kind of like my desolate flat land covered in red dirt, even if it does come with 70-mile-an-hour winds. But one thing I have learned living out here is that trying to keep delicate green things alive is pretty much impossible, especially when horses are my first priority. So my flower beds are actually rock beds, and my plants on my front porch are all made of metal. Okay, before we get going, I want to ask you guys, please go leave a rating and a review for this podcast. If your podcasting app doesn't allow you to do that, you could hop over to, I think, the iTunes or the Apple Podcasts versions will let you do that. And if you don't want to go over there, go to Facebook and you can make recommendations and do like stars and reviews and things like that on Facebook. So I love to see that kind of stuff. It really does incentivize me to keep going and to keep doing these, you know, like commercial free. I don't have ad spots that you have to figure out how to skip through really fast. I don't know. I listen to a lot of podcasts and every one of them basically has, you know, 3 to 15 minutes of ads playing throughout it at some point. And I always try to skip through them myself, and I don't know. So I hope that you guys appreciate that I've been able to do these without any ads. Of course, Blue Bonnet and Stride Animal Health support my ability to do this. So you definitely will hear from me about those two brands. They're also the two brands that I formulate for, right? So the feeds and the supplements that are made by Stride Animal Health and Blue Bonnet Feeds are formulas that I've actually formulated myself and am responsible for. So I have full understanding and knowledge of every single item that goes into those. So it's really easy for me to trust them and be comfortable with them. And if you're having a hard time finding me on social media, you can find me by searching at Dr. Jimmy, Equine Nutritionist. Any of those words should help pull that up. Even if you just search Feed Room Chemist, I'm sure it should land you somewhere close to one of my pages. So, all right, let's get going. Let's talk about muscle myopathies. For those of you wondering, Yes, we are now starting to understand that, you know, tying up that simple term isn't quite so simple. So I did an episode on PSSM or tying up way back. I think it was almost 3 years ago. Episode number 32, in case anybody wants to jump back and listen to it. But I felt like this was a topic that really deserved kind of a refresher course. And, you know, frankly, we have some learnings over the last 3 years in regard to, you know, the different types of myopathies and really differentiating the way that you handle these horses in terms of diet. So Dr. Stephanie Valberg has really led the charge in terms of research and helping us better understand the genetic component of what is going on in horses with muscle conditions. She's really, her and her research team have developed diagnostics and tools that can really help pinpoint specific genetic mutations and kind of dig that next level deeper into understanding the multitude of muscle myopathies that horses can be dealing with. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the term myopathy, it's really just a nerdy word that refers to a disease that affects the muscles in the body. And more specifically, like the muscles responsible for locomotion, like movement, right? So not talking about like your heart muscle. This is more your muscles that are causing movement, moving the body, moving the limbs. Then on top of Dr. Valberg's laboratory research on those various muscle diseases, which I'll explain more as we get going, I personally have also had some learnings from the field through horses that my team has been consulting for. So I want to walk through kind of some protocols. I'm going to throw in some tips of things that I will typically lean on for horses that are dealing with different types of muscle myopathies. And I'm going to kind of describe, you know, the approaches that I take for each one, because it's not just a blanket, you know, my horse ties up, do this one thing and it'll fix everything. It just doesn't work like that. So now, before I talk about some of the protocols that I do typically use or recommend on muscle myopathy horses, I want to point out these are experiences, not experiments. Okay. So I say that because the scientist in me or the researcher in me just like cannot even begin to call, you know, a one horse trial an experiment or research, right? Because like a true research experiment has a control group and it's done, you know, with as much isolation towards outside influences as possible. And then, of course, you have, you know, replication, meaning the same treatment gets applied to multiple horses so that you can then run statistics and then determine whether or not that treatment truly had an effect. So there's a lot that goes into it. If you're not familiar, haven't directly been involved in experimental trials or research studies, you know, it can kind of rub you the wrong way when someone, you know, takes their one or two horses on their property and says, I'm going to do an experiment with this supplement or this liniment or whatever. It just, you know, again, those are not experiments, those are experiences. So, and they can be valuable. You can absolutely get some valuable information from them, but I just want to make sure that everyone understands the difference. Sorry, getting a little bit deep in that, but, you know, I think sometimes, you know, what's, hang on, before I get out of this hole, let me just dig a little bit deeper. So like, sometimes something might maybe seems to have worked for one horse in their normal environment, but just because it does work for that one horse doesn't mean that that one thing that you were trying to test was the exact cause of the change, right? Because there's so many other variables. And so if you don't have multiple horses and that isolation and everything, just everything, it's called confounding. Basically everything gets kind of mixed up and gray and overlaps and it's a little bit hazy and shady. And then it's like, you can't really tell whether or not that one single thing truly made that change. Okay. So that's the point of research, is trying to eliminate all of the shady and all of the gray and get to where you can evaluate that one single thing. Now, on the flip side, I work with a team of nutrition consultants, so I have a lot of exposure to a lot of horses, right? A lot of different horses. And over the last 3 years, you know, we've really started to narrow in on some certain protocols that have seemed to have some very positive effects on horses with different types of muscle myopathies. And so, you know, like as we were going along, like we'd see an improvement in, you know, the first 5, 10, 15 horses. And it's kind of like, okay, you know, glad each horse is doing good. This is promising, you know, I'm happy for this client, but you know, I wouldn't have necessarily bet the farm that it was, you know, so super dependent on a specific nutrition protocol, right? Like I wouldn't have put that much money on the line that it was just that nutrition protocol that made the difference. Now, fast forward, we've put many, many more horses on these different protocols, and we continue to get these same, you know, positive results. So as time has gone on, and as we have used these protocols on, you know, a larger number of horses, I'm becoming more convinced that we really are able to make a difference within the body by how we feed, how we supplement, and how we manage these horses. Or at least I feel good enough about the results that we have seen over the last few years to like publicly make these suggestions. And so as I go through this, I want, you know, as I start sharing these tips and as I start sharing these, you know, quote protocols that I'll use, I want you to remember that you can't cherry pick the items that I share. Okay. You can't just try, you know, let's say there's like a 4-part protocol. You can't just pick 2 parts of it and then try that and say it didn't work, or, you know, just like your chance of success is not very high if you only do half of what we're suggesting or what, you know, what we've had the best experience with. So each item in these protocols has a reason, and they're all interconnected, right? So it's really important for you to truly implement every step. If you are dealing with a horse with one of these conditions and you really want to try to take an intentional approach to helping them manage the condition. Okay, let's do this. I figured it would be best to briefly describe a muscle myopathy and then explain the protocol that I would typically use in that situation. Now, there are certainly some, you know, foundational items that will apply across the board, and then there are certain things that will apply maybe to, you know, maybe 2 of the myopathies but not the others. And so I'll try to highlight those out, but I'm also going to try to avoid repeating myself in every single one of them. So I may, if I go through a full protocol once, I may on the next one, you know, if the bulk of it is the same, I may just refer you back to that section. So that's kind of my plan here, in an effort to try to keep this episode from becoming like 2 hours long. Okay, let's start out with ER, so exertional rhabdomyolysis. Okay, this is kind of what I kind of consider the classic tying up, if you will. Okay, so basically what you're going to see if a horse is dealing with this kind of tying up, they're going to present with pain, they're going to be stiff, they don't want to move, they're probably going to have some pretty profuse sweating. It may be, you know, sweating in the neck, it may be sweating that comes up under the belly and up into the flanks. They're going to have very tight and very painful muscles, particularly along the top of their back, like along the lumbar and over their croup. When you see a horse that is tying up like this, sometimes it can be confused for colic. They look very similar. And so, you know, I think it's normal for people to jump directly to, oh, this horse is colicking, get them to the vet. But I just want to plant the seed in the back of your mind to pay attention that it might not necessarily be colic, it might actually be tying up. So in order to determine whether or not the episode was a tie-up episode, your vet will typically diagnose that. So that's something that your vet will need to do. They'll pull blood and they'll run it. Typically what we're trying to evaluate is the serum CK and AST levels. So horses that deal with ER, they can have sporadic episodes, or they can be more chronic, right? Like an ongoing, like they have tie-up episodes, you know, maybe multiple times a year. It can be a more frequent deal. Now, a horse that has just a sporadic episode, right? Those horses don't have like a true defect in their muscle. Instead, that was probably caused by an environmental situation or that there was some kind of physical stress factor at play. Okay. So examples, you know, if you were to work a horse too hard, maybe after they've had a little bit of time off, or if they're not in good enough shape to work at the intensity level that you would ask them to work, those are scenarios where a horse can tie up. They can also tie up on hot days where they're being worked really hard. Endurance horses, this can be a problem in endurance horses, or any horse that's just being worked hard where their body temperature becomes high, they're sweating a lot, they're losing fluids, they're losing electrolytes, they're depleting their muscle energy stores. All of those things can cause a horse to just have one, you know, kind of random tie-up episode that isn't necessarily linked to any kind of genetic mutation. One other time that a horse seems to be susceptible to sporadic tie-up episodes is if they are coming off of a respiratory infection. So if your horse has a cough or if your horse has nasal discharge, it's just best not to exercise your horse. And we're not entirely sure why that, you know, respiratory infection is connected to a tie-up episode, but there does just seem to be a tendency for that to happen. So it's just something to be mindful of. Okay, so if you have a horse that ties up, just ER, exertional rhabdomyolysis is what it's called. How do we manage that? Okay, this is where I'm going to get into kind of my protocols, right? So first step, no green grass. I'm sorry. I know. We all love to kick our horses out on green pasture and let them be free, and then we don't have to worry about buying hay. But this really is a foundational item for a horse that is dealing with muscle myopathies. The second item in my protocol is test the sugar in your hay, or just avoid cool season hay. Okay. I get it. Excuse me. Not everyone is into hay testing, right? And as much as it pains me, I know that the vast majority of you have never, like not even one single time in your entire horse owning life ever sent your hay off for testing. Did I mention that this makes me sad? But if you have a horse with a muscle myopathy, you need to understand what the sugar content is in that horse's total diet. And the only way to know this is by knowing what the sugar content is in your hay. So, general rule of thumb, I like to keep the hay under 12% NSC, which is your starch plus your sugar content. If you are interested in sending your hay off for analysis, Equa Analytical is the lab that I really like. You can find them online. It's just equa-analytical.com. If you are not interested in testing your hay, you're generally going to be safe if you go with warm season grasses. So Bermuda grass, you know, your coastal Bermuda grass, just, you know, basically any species of Bermuda grass. And then also teff hay. So I didn't say Tifton. I said teff, like T-E-F-F. And I did episodes on both Bermuda grass and teff. It's been, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 episodes back, but you can go look those up if you want to dig a little bit more into those grass species. And then you're also almost always safe with alfalfa. That's one tricky one where people get confused, right? They think that protein is the issue in tying up, and that's not the case. So, you know, feeding a high protein hay is perfectly safe, which means alfalfa is safe. Alfalfa is surprisingly low in sugar, especially compared to cool season grasses. So, you know, if you were to compare alfalfa to like orchard grass, timothy, brome, you know, any of those cool season grass species, those grass species are actually going to, as a general rule of thumb, have a higher sugar content than alfalfa. So if you have a horse that ties up, alfalfa is your friend, alfalfa and warm season grasses. And if you don't have access to alfalfa or warm season grasses, and you have to rely on cool season species, that's where you really, really need to be testing the sugar content of your hay so that you know what you're dealing with. And if it's high, you can then manage accordingly. Okay, step number three in my protocol is proper vitamins and minerals. Now, vitamin E and selenium tend to get the spotlight the most often, but many minerals and even vitamins play a role in things like, you know, cellular fluid balance and the contraction of these muscles, okay? So I want to point out that it's not about loading up at these crazy high levels, right? It's about making sure that the foundation is covered relative to the horse's needs and lifestyle, okay? It drives me absolutely crazy when I hear someone make a blanket recommendation like, feed more vitamin E and selenium, right? Because in a muscle myopathy situation, it's not that elevating vitamin E and selenium helps reduce tying up. The real deal here is that vitamin E and selenium deficiencies may cause more frequent or severe tie-up episodes just due to oxidative injury that occurs within the muscle cells. So what I'm trying to say is you need to make sure that you are supplying the right amount of vitamin E and selenium, which are two very important antioxidants, but you don't need to go feed 4x the recommended rates, right? And just understand that feeding 4 or 5x of the recommended level of those is not going to stop episodes any more than if you were just to feed the proper amount, okay? So most quality diet balancers and most quality, fully fortified feeds are going to accomplish that. They're going to cover those bases. So kind of those of you who are maybe looking for specific balancers, my go-to in terms of, you know, like a vitamin and mineral basis covering that basic foundation is a supplement called 101 Diet Balancer, which is made by Stride Animal Health. And then I add plain white salt. Okay, so just 101 Diet Balancer and plain white salt is going to cover all of those foundational needs in terms of vitamins and minerals, okay? Another option, now 101 Diet Balancer is a pellet. If you would rather go with a loose powder, then I lean on a product called Nutrimix Plus. And I also really like that one if you need some extra like mane, tail, hoof support. It has the like mega dose of biotin in it. It supplies 100 milligrams of biotin per day, along with the needed levels of lysine and methionine and then those trace minerals, which the 101 also contains the research proven dose of effective biotin, but it doesn't have the mega dose. But the 101 does have those, you know, the trace minerals and the lysine and the methionine and all that. So really the only difference between those two products in terms of like deciding which one to go with is 101 is pelleted, Nutrimix Plus is a powder, and then Nutrimix Plus has the mega dose biotin in it. So if someone needs, you know, looking for long mane, long tail, and extra hoof quality, hoof integrity, I'll lean on the Nutrimix Plus. Then if I'm in a situation where I'm working with a horse that maybe we need to be using a feed rather than a diet balancer or a supplement, I will typically go with either Intensify Omega Force or Equiline ProCare, and both of those are by Blue Bonnet Feeds. And I'm not going to get into the super details of how I would choose between the two, but the kind of basic premise is if you have a horse that's very anxious or is dealing with digestive concerns, then I would go with Equiline ProCare. And if you have a horse that you are just trying to maintain and who is otherwise healthy and doesn't have like major concerns like, you know, ulcers, leaky gut, hindgut dysbiosis, any of that kind of stuff, and you're looking for like just good preventative maintenance and a good defense against that stuff, then that's when I go with the Intensify Omega Force. Also, the feeding rates are just a little bit different. So the Intensify Omega Force is going to have a little lower feeding rate. It's a little bit more dense. The nutrition is more concentrated in it, so you feed less. And then the Equiline ProCare is a beet pulp based feed. It's a little bit fluffier. It's lighter. The volume will be bigger, and the feeding rate itself will also be bigger on that. So that's kind of like the really quick primer on how I choose between those two feeds. Now, if a horse has been tying up in hot weather, or if they're tying up after really intense exercise, or if the horse maybe doesn't have a history of tying up and has no genetic predisposition to it, then those things tell me that that horse likely just needs a little bit of extra support from a metabolic pH standpoint. So in that situation, I will incorporate either travel paste or a loose powder called TurboMag BCAA. And then kind of lastly on that piece, on this supplement piece, if a horse needs a boost of vitamin E, I will typically do a quarter scoop of Stride Animal Health's vitamin E C product. And the reason I go there is just because it's a natural form of vitamin E and it's mixed with an antioxidant booster. Okay, the fourth tip on protocol for these horses that are tying up is consistent movement, right? So train at the intensity that you wish to compete. For example, if you get a horse out and you put it on a hot walker for 30 minutes on the weekdays, and then you go for, you know, a 10-mile ride through the mountains on the weekend, there's a much higher chance of your horse having an episode because their muscles are being overexerted, right? They're not used to that kind of exercise or that kind of work, right? They're not conditioned for it. So another example, let's say that your horse is fit and your horse is in shape, but it's been raining all week and you were not able to get out and exercise. But you decide to go ahead and take them to a race or a show on the weekend anyway. They are going to be much more likely to tie up after they perform at that race or at that show. So rest is not necessarily your friend if you have a horse that is tying up, that is having these ER episodes, right? Now, with the exception of resting them after an episode, right? So I'm talking about rest before exercise is not your friend. If you have a horse that does have an episode, then yes, you do need to rest them after an episode. Follow your veterinarian's guidelines there on when to return to an exercise program. But, you know, typically, like this is just generally speaking, right? Consult with your veterinarian. Generally speaking, it's stall rest for 1 to 2 days. Then you move them to paddock turnout for 1 to 2 weeks. And then after that, you can kind of start to slowly work them back into that daily exercise program. But again, don't just, even if they were a fit horse at the beginning, don't go full bore and just expect them to jump right into the same intensity that they were at when you stopped. The next one that we're going to talk about is RER, which is recurrent exertional rhabdomyolysis. So this is going to present very similar to the ER, the regular exertional rhabdomyolysis, which we just talked about. The difference between the two is that this one is recurring, right? Hence the name recurrent exertional rhabdomyolysis, RER instead of just ER. Okay. So this one is going to be more related to calcium regulation within the cells. It typically happens in horses who are very fit and are typically on a very well-balanced diet. And it seems to be most common in young thoroughbred fillies. Okay, so especially those who are very anxious or very nervous, right? So this is more common on the racetracks. Now, they have not found a specific gene that is tied to RER, but there may be maybe kind of like both a genetic and environmental combination that has to come into effect for it to actually kind of show itself or play out. So if you missed the episode on epigenetics, definitely go back and check that out. It was, I think it was just two episodes back, episode 113. And it talks about how certain environmental and dietary factors have the ability, right? I'm talking environmental factors have the ability to turn genes on or off, okay? So it's possible that that is what is happening with these RER. They have a tendency toward tying up, but it doesn't necessarily happen until they're put in like a high stress environment, or they become overly excited or whatever the factor. Okay, so how do we look at managing an RER horse? First, make sure you're covering those bases for the vitamin and mineral content. So since this form of tying up has kind of a calcium regulation twist, I almost always will layer a magnesium-based metabolic pH balancer on top of my base feed. And the one that I specifically use is called TurboMag BCAA, and you would use that on a daily basis. Now, the concept here is that by changing the magnesium levels and kind of manipulating the cation-anion balance of the diet, you can help improve the movement of the calcium ions in and out of the cell membranes, and then also support cellular hydration. Okay. That was kind of a short one. Let's move into kind of more the classic tie-up that everyone wants to talk about, PSSM, right? So let's start by talking about PSSM1. PSSM stands for polysaccharide storage myopathy. So if RER had your mind on thoroughbreds, then PSSM will certainly have your mind on quarter horses. The American Quarter Horse Association has been funding research into this disease since the 90s, and it has really allowed researchers to identify specific tests and really help kind of narrow in on the causes of this disease, particularly from a genetic standpoint. So PSSM1 occurs when there is a genetic mutation in a gene, and that mutation alters how the muscles handle glycogen. So a horse with PSSM1 will have what we call an abnormal stain, meaning if you were to send in a muscle biopsy and look at that under a microscope, that stain or that slide that you're looking at under the microscope, that picture that you're looking at basically of that horse's, a piece of that horse's muscle would not look the way that it should. In addition to the abnormal stain on that microscope slide, a PSSM1 horse will also show a mutation in the genetic sequence. Now, this mutation is linked to the glycogen synthase enzyme. And basically, what is thought to happen is that this enzyme becomes overactive, particularly in the presence of insulin, which then causes constant production of glycogen. When glycogen is being produced, so you've got glycogen being produced, but then the breakdown of glycogen is impaired. And so when you have that all going on, you end up basically with this deficit of energy in the muscle cell. And you guessed it, a horse that ties up. So these horses are typically going to have, you know, the same physical outward signs that I mentioned at the very beginning of this episode, right? They're going to be stiff, reluctant to move. They might have a shifting lameness. They might have a really tight abdomen. Tremors in the flank area are more common. They may just sweat profusely. A lot of times these horses will stretch out and look like they're trying to urinate as well, but not actually urinate. We call that posturing. A horse with a really serious episode, a really serious tie-up episode, will also have dark colored urine. And I don't mean like dark yellow. I mean, it will literally look like a cup of coffee. It is so dark, like it is almost black, okay? And the reason for that is because all of these muscle proteins are being released into the bloodstream, and then they're being passed through the kidney into the urine. And that can actually be a really serious condition that can lead to kidney damage if the horse is dehydrated on top of all of this. So how do we manage? If we have a horse that has the genetic mutation, we know that they're predisposed to it. What do we do? Okay, here's your protocol. Step number one, sugar. Sugar is the big player in this scenario because of what it does to the blood glucose and insulin levels in the body. So, you know, kind of back to the basics that I mentioned in the very beginning, no green grass. Test your hay for sugar levels, right? Try to keep your forage diet, your hay diet, under 12% NSC or non-structural carbohydrate. And if you're not going to test your hay, then you need to lean on either alfalfa or you need to lean on a warm season grass like Bermuda grass or teff. Number two, avoid things that are really high in starches and sugars. Okay, so corn, oats, barley, all of those cereal grains are between 50 to 75% starch and sugar. Okay, so those are not your friend in this situation. check, you know, kind of like step number three, check the NSC content of your feed itself and lean on a feed that balances your forage in terms of your total diet NSC. Okay, so I say that because what I will see sometimes is if someone sees the word molasses, let's say, on an ingredient listing, they will just freak out and say, oh my goodness, I cannot feed that feed, right? Well, it could be that it was dried molasses at very small levels to help with flavoring. It could be that it was fairly dilute liquid molasses that was sprayed on to help settle dust or to help soften beet pulp shreds or whatever the case. Like there are certainly reasons that you would use molasses in a formulation. And you can do it at levels that don't just flood that feed with sugar content. Now, how does the average person know whether the level of sugar in that feed or whether the amount of molasses in that feed is an acceptable level? You just look at the sugar content, right? So NSC is just a mathematical equation. It's just the addition of starch and sugar. And if it's not listed directly on your feed tag, your feed manufacturer should have something on the website or should at least be able to tell you if you call in how much starch and how much sugar is in that feed. And so as long as your starch plus your sugar in that feed are at a lower level, you know, so, and again, I want to be really careful here about like giving a specific number because it's not about what the feed is, it's about what the total diet is, okay? So let me maybe give you an example. If your hay is testing, let's say 10% NSC or less, generally speaking, you have room for your grain to be, you know, 15 to 17% NSC, right? So you still would be under the total diet recommendation of having your NSC under 12%. I hope that makes sense. Okay. So the reason for that is because the bulk of the diet should be forage. So if you feed 16 pounds per day of hay that tests 10%, that leaves you with wiggle room on the extra 6 pounds of grain that you might be feeding, right? So I could bore you with this math, but I'm pretty sure I've done that in past episodes, number one. I guess if someone wants me to write out the logic or write out the math in this, just drop a comment on the social media post for this specific episode, and I'll just type it out right there for anybody that's having a hard time wrapping their head around it. But bottom line is, if your hay tests 10% NSC or less, and you're feeding 16 pounds per day of it, and then you're feeding a grain at 6 pounds per day, and you have room for that grain to be as high as 17% NSC, and the total diet still be under 12%. So that's kind of like your take-home general guidelines. So again, I don't just totally get hammered in on making sure on a feed having to be a certain NSC. I do get pretty particular about making sure that the hay is a certain NSC because that is the bulk of the diet. All right, kind of step number four in this protocol, after you're completely certain that you have that total diet NSC ironed out, you need to make sure that you're covering your minerals and your vitamin needs. So just as I explained at the beginning of this episode, I won't go through all of it again, but electrolytes, vitamins, minerals, all of it needs to be fed at appropriate levels. You can't just choose a random vitamin and mineral, right? Vitamin E and selenium. You can't just cherry pick two random things and think that if you were to oversupply that or feed it by 10x the requirement, that that's going to fix the issue, because it won't. Okay. And again, I covered that in the ER portion. So you can go back and listen to that if you fell asleep during that segment. Now, as like a last step, kind of fifth step in this protocol, this is where I start to really get tailored with stuff. After I have covered all of those basics, I Well, all of those basics plus consistent exercise, right? So that's one thing I forgot to mention. PSSM horses do need consistent exercise. So very much in the same way that I was talking earlier, you know, make sure that they are getting, you know, consistent work on a daily basis and make sure that they are worked at a level that matches the intensity that they will be asked to perform about or that they will be asked to perform at. Okay. Now, the fifth thing then is I will pull out a specific supplement. It's called Moving Up, made by Stride Animal Health. The reason I use Moving Up in a horse with PSSM1 is because the issue is really a matter of energy deficit within the cells due to improper glycogen utilization. Okay, so Moving Up contains an amino acid derivative that basically triggers kind of alternate enzymes. And so what it does is it cues the mitochondria within the cells to utilize fatty acids for energy. So it's basically kind of getting the body to use different energy pathways, right, than what it would typically be used to do. And also, when you pair that specific derivative that's in Moving Up with the added antioxidant support that's also in Moving Up, there's research out there that shows that you can actually help reduce muscle damage and lessen the chances of a horse tying up. Okay, many of you deal with PSSM1 horses, but there are also a large group of you who have what we call PSSM2 horses, okay? So again, still polysaccharide storage myopathy. It's just the second version, okay? So how do you differentiate between what 1 and 2 is? Basically, what happens is the PSSM type 2 horses are the horses that do not have the PSSM1 genetic mutation, but they do have abnormal staining for muscle glycogen. Okay, so again, if you were to do the genetic test, there's nothing that will come back on their genetic panel. They will look they will look totally normal, no mutations genetically. But if you were to take a muscle biopsy and send it off for analysis and have it stained and look at it under the microscope, they would have abnormal staining for muscle glycogen, okay? So again, if your horse does not have the genetic mutation but does have abnormal muscle biopsy result, then those horses get classified as PSSM2. These horses, they're gonna present very similar from like an outward symptoms. They're going to be very similar to the other myopathies during an actual episode. So they're going to be stiff, reluctant to move. They will typically have elevated serum CK and AST levels. The difference in PSSM2 horses is that there is also a secondary complaint of muscle atrophy. Okay, so these horses, they might present with maybe a slight gait abnormality, right? Just like a slight, you know, maybe a touch of a lameness or like just something that's not quite right. They will generally have sore muscles. They often will have a drop in their energy level or have an unwillingness to perform that hits them about 5 to 10 minutes into their exercise routine. These horses might have very painful and firm back muscles and hindquarter muscles, and they are often unwilling, let's say, to round their backs and really engage their hindquarters. So these horses may have atrophy of the muscles also more quickly when they are pulled out of work. And then they can have slightly elevated serum CK activity, but not always. So typically when you're talking like the warm blood breeds, those are the ones that don't necessarily have that elevation in the serum CK activity. Whereas in your quarter horse breeds, those type 2 PSSM horses do tend to have the elevated serum CK. So it's not this really super clear black and white situation. You kind of have to be a detective and really understand the, you know, breed of the horse and the history of the horse and what they're doing. And there's just like this whole story that has to fold together really to help you understand or identify whether or not a horse is dealing with PSSM2. And it can also be challenging because, you know, a lot of these symptoms, these things that I described are, they're the same as like if a horse had poor saddle fit or had, you know, lameness issues in their stifles or their hocks or, you know, or kissing spine, or there are so many different things that these same symptoms can overlap with. So you have to just, this one can be really tough. It can be really tough, especially without that muscle biopsy. But that muscle biopsy is really the way to get that definitive kind of diagnosis on these horses. So how do we manage? Sugar management isn't quite as critical in a PSSM2 horse, but I do still like to be mindful of it, especially since PSSM2 isn't super well understood yet. So I will generally deploy kind of the same foundational principles for a PSSM2 horse that I would for a horse with ER or PSSM1. So, you know, monitor that total diet NSC, test your hay, avoid things like corn, oats, barley, and sweet feeds. You know, make sure that those foundational vitamins and minerals are in play at appropriate levels for that horse's size and for their activity level. Then secondly, you know, daily movement and exercise are critical. So particularly for chronic PSSM2 cases, prolonged rest after an episode is actually counterproductive. So if you have a horse that has one of these episodes, you know, giving them stall rest for 2 weeks is not going to be the best approach, right? You want to do really light movement, keep them moving. When you do put them back into work, or even if one of these horses, it's been a long time since they've had an episode, even in your daily work, warm up really slow, right? Go slow, ease into the workout routine. Just do all of it really long and slow, okay? And then core exercises are also really beneficial for these horses. And you can, I'm sure that there's just a host of those on the internet that you can go search and look up videos on different core exercises that you can do with these horses. Now, kind of the difference then, so all of those things that I just mentioned are really pretty much the same as what I would recommend for a PSSM1 horse. Now, the place where I kind of deviate a little bit on a PSSM2 is in the management of, you know, adding a quality amino acid. And so particularly because muscle deterioration along that top line is a key factor in this condition, I will lean on a supplement called Competitive Edge. It's made by Stride Animal Health. It contains a full amino acid profile plus antioxidants, vitamin E, vitamin C, and it comes in at only 11% NSC. So again, as long as your total diet is, you know, at an appropriate level, you can safely add this amino acid on top of it and not worry about adding extra glucose or sugar or causing insulin spikes. You can even use that supplement, the Competitive Edge, kind of like think about it almost as a pre-work supplement, meaning, you know, you can feed it while you're tacking up, and it's alfalfa based. And so that alfalfa base will also have added benefits of helping neutralize that stomach acid. And then you get the, you know, the normal benefit of having all of those amino acids to supply that muscle regeneration and rebuilding after a workout. So it's really kind of a cool, comprehensive amino acid supplement that I've had really good luck using on these PSSM2 horses. The next myopathy I'm going to talk about is MFM, so myofibrillar myopathy. This myopathy has frequently been grouped with the PSSM2 horses, and it's possible that there is a connection between them, but researchers are still trying to kind of sort all of that out. MFM seems to be most common in Arabians and warm bloods, and it walks and talks a lot like PSSM2 in terms of what we would see in outward signs. you know, these horses, they're not going to have a genetic mutation, but the clinical diagnosis is, again, made through muscle biopsy. And so what they're looking at there is that there's a certain cytoskeletal protein called desmin. And if that desmin is showing in abnormal amounts or abnormal shapes on that muscle stain, on that biopsy stain, then that tells us that the horse is dealing with MFM and not necessarily just PSSM2. Okay, so how do we manage an MFM horse? I'm going to spare us all the repetition, and I'm just going to refer back to the management protocols mentioned for the PSSM2 horses. However, there is one other addition, and I would definitely incorporate an antioxidant supplement because oxidative stress likely plays a role in that degenerative process of those muscles. So my go-to here is Stride's vitamin EC product. Again, that was the natural E with that antioxidant booster. Some people get hung up in hitting a certain fat content or a certain starch and sugar content in an MFM horse, but it appears that, you know, MFM horses, you just need to be mindful about moderation on both fronts, right? And don't go to the extremes, right? So don't go looking for like the super lowest starch diet you can feed. Don't go looking for the absolute highest fat that you can find, like, you know, kind of just everything in moderation, right? You don't have to go to the ultras on the starch and sugar. You really just need to be more mindful about, you know, exercise consistency, amino acid profiles, and then the antioxidant support. That's kind of where I place the largest priority for those horses. Okay, there's a lot of information that I did not cover on these conditions. So I am going to drop some links in the show notes where you can go learn more, especially if you have a horse that has one of these specific muscle myopathies. And then if you're confused about what to do with your horse, you can always reach out for a free nutrition consult with the team at Bluebonnet Feeds. And then I will go make posts for this episode on my social channels, and I look forward to continuing the conversation with you guys over there. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Feed Room Chemist. If you like what you hear, be sure to share with your friends, post to social media, or give us a review. And as Winston Churchill used to say, no hour of life is wasted that is spent in the saddle. So go saddle up.